Welcome to the Strength Coach Experience podcast. I'm your host, Joe Lego. And here we go. Welcome everyone to the Strength Coach Experience, episode number 63. Today I want to welcome Rocky Snyder. Rocky has two podcasts of his own. He has the Rock Fit Files and Zealous. I had the pleasure of being on one of his podcasts as a guest, and that's kind of how we met, and now he's going to be on mine here. He is also an author, a speaker, and he's a presenter, travels around the country and talks about movement and different things. Great mind in the industry, and also author of several books, which we'll get into. And I just want to thank everybody again for their continued support. Rocky, thank you so much for coming on. It's a pleasure. Really enjoyed being on your podcast, and now I'm happy to have you on mine so we can get into a conversation again and just talk about some stuff.
Well, Joe, thanks. I mean, it was a real fun conversation we had earlier. So if it's going to be anything like that, I'm really looking forward to it. So thanks.
Absolutely. Me too. Yeah. In there, nice in California. I'm in Texas, but it's 65 today. It's kind of weird. It was 100 the last 2 days.
You got to love that. It always keeps you on your toes. Yeah. Here it's rather boring, you know, on the central coast of California, where I am in Santa Cruz, it's foggy in the morning and then nothing but sunshine in the afternoon. You get kind of tired of it, but it's an okay kind of tired.
Yeah, exactly. Like, oh my God, it's sunny again, you know, so it's, but exactly. I think that the sun is always the best, right? Coming from New York City, I've noticed I'm in a much better mood every day since I go outside, and it's the sky. There's not a cloud in the sky and it's sunny outside in the heat. Everybody's like, oh, what do you think of the heat? I said, I don't care, because in New York, it's cloudy for 3 months out of the year or 4 months or however happens, and it's zero. So I'll trade the 100 degrees for that any day.
Any day. I grew up in New England, so I know what you mean. It's just, you go outside, overcast skies, it kind of gives you a certain kind of demeanor, kind of attitude. But when you wake up and the sun comes out, man, you're ready to go. There's a whole bunch of things that's just waiting for you at your doorstep. So it's good.
Yeah, absolutely. I think that's a very interesting take, because for me, it's, you know, I started running and being outside a lot more, but the sun does something. You know, if you wake up on a day and you go outside and you're drinking your coffee and the breeze is in the air and it's a nice 70, you're like, you know what, maybe I'll walk today, right? Or I'll run. You know, I think it adds, or you know, you don't really want to be inside. You can kind of manipulate your day, if you will, to be like, okay, I should be outside because it's just too nice to kind of let that go. We're in, you know, in New England, and nothing against New England. I love growing up there, but when it's cold out, it's very easy to, A, if you have something planned outside, you know, to skip that, or, you know, or definitely not, oh, I'm going to make an attempt to go outside when it's 25, 30, or, you know, the sun's out. I think the sun, you know, just having it on your face and things like that in the morning are do wonders for, you know, mood, but also drive inside your body.
I agree. I mean, growing up, like I say, growing up in the Northeast there, when it's winter time, you don't escape it. It's winter everywhere. But where I am now, not to rub any dirt in it or anything, but we can drive to the winter. You know, I live on the coast and we can surf. And then in a few hours time, we're up in the Sierras and we're snowboarding. So you actually can drive to the snow, but then you can drive away from it. And then it's in the 60s. So it's not bad.
Yeah, no, you have that nice dynamic, you know, very important.
Definitely. It's a nice lifestyle that it's a gift every day. I wake up and I just feel blessed. So, and of course, in this environment, you got a lot of active bodies. So it's conducive to having a movement studio like we do.
Yeah, absolutely. Very important. Of course, if you have to be outside all day and in minimal clothing, it gives you more of a drive to get in the gym and work out and make sure that your diet and things are on point.
Truly. We've got the Santa Cruz Mountains here. So mountain biking, and actually just the cycling industry is huge in Santa Cruz. We've got a lot of companies that promote mountain biking, road cycling, and so on. And then of course, surfing is what we're most known for. So we got the surf industry, but disc golf is huge here. We've got sometimes the world championships are right here at one of the local golf courses. And of course, hiking through the coastal redwoods, it's just a very active community. So we've got a lot of different types of enthusiasts that walk through our doors or that should live in the area.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think it's a psychological thing, right? If you're somebody listening and you have the opportunity, right, and you want to get fit and you don't really like the winter, you know, I think that there should be more said about maybe moving to places where there are fit communities or there's more stuff outside, right? Because I think naturally you'll want to get outside, right? Want to make changes, you know, when you surround yourself with people who are active. So I think I always thought it was a very interesting dynamic, you know, going to California and visiting. Everybody's always outside, you know, walking around, or coming here to Texas, right? Everybody's running. Everybody's always outside by the pool. And, you know, not that it's not judgmental or anything, but it seems a lot of people are, you know, they put a lot more time into being active because there's that opportunity every day to be outside and going in ocean and things like that.
Well said. Well said.
Absolutely. So why don't we just, you know, kind of kick off and go into your background, right? Growing up, and then we'll kind of segue into how you got into where you are now. And then we'll kind of see where the conversation takes us and what happens like we did last time.
Yeah, sounds great. Well, as I said earlier, you know, the Northeast was a great place to grow up. And I was one of those kids where the parents would just get tired of hearing the back door slam all the time. And so they just said, hey, either in or out. And I chose out and I just stayed out. I'd go camping, hiking, canoeing. I was a big part of the Boy Scouts in my hometown. And so we would go to the northern Maine woods or in the backwoods of Western Massachusetts and New Hampshire and so on the weekends. And I just thoroughly enjoyed getting entrenched in outdoor activity. And I wasn't much of a gym rat at all. I didn't think that was something that was, I didn't really look at it as something that was enjoyable. However, somewhere in my late teen years, my friend took me to a gym and we started working out after work. And I liked how it was transforming me. And so I found that I was pretty good at it. And I decided, well, yeah, this is better than doing other things. So I used it as a wonderful procrastination tool. If I needed to study for an exam or something, I would just go instead to the gym and work out. It didn't do well for my grades, mind you, but I ended up graduating somehow. I don't know how that happened, but I finished at the University of Massachusetts in Amherst. And then I got a job in Yellowstone National Park right after graduation. And I just thought, oh, I'm going to go in the national park system and travel from one to the other throughout the year. And really just live like, well, I'm dating myself, but like Grizzly Adams or Jeremiah Johnson and, you know, just a backwoods kind of person. But as it turned out, a few of my buddies were traveling past and they said, we're moving to California. And for this sheltered New Englander, I mean, Wyoming and Yellowstone was a huge stretch for me, but California, that's unheard of. But I came out and visited, and that was in the early 90s, 1990. And I just loved it. I thought this was a fantastic place. And so I eventually moved here. Within a year, I had moved to Santa Cruz. And as it turned out, within a year or two, I got a job at a local health club. And it was at about that time that personal training was beginning. And it had come up from LA. One of the managers had come up from the LA area where personal training was really taken off. And he developed a program or a personal training department at this health club. And I was one of the first ones he chose to start off. And I thought this was the greatest career you could imagine. Oh my gosh, I'm going to teach people how to count to 10 and lift heavy things off the ground and put them back down again. I mean, this is great. Of course, that was so long ago and so many things have changed in that time. And in the course of time, I really found that this is something I truly enjoyed investigating, the human body and how it moves, how it adapts, how it doesn't adapt, the problems that can come about, but the solutions that can be created. And it has just allowed me to follow the rabbit down the hole into this amazing wonderland where I haven't met Alice yet, but there's a few mad hatters out there every now and then I bump into. But it's just been amazing studying biomechanics and posture alignments and all the different movement practices around the world and the things they have to offer. And then getting into brain science and motor neurology, it never stops, Joe. It just keeps on going. And And so now I know less than I started. I think I thought I knew everything. And then as time goes by, I realize, boy, how little I know. And so I just keep this journey of learning going on, and I'm never underwhelmed. I'm always amazed at what there is out there to learn. And it's just a never ending process. So I guess that's the origin story in a nutshell.
Absolutely. And a phenomenal story. And again, I can relate, because I think a lot of us the same. We started out, you know, in my era, but, you know, trying to look like Ronnie Coleman, and then you go down a rabbit hole, and then all of a sudden you start to pick up the neurology, right? The biomechanics and how the body moves. And you realize that you don't know anything, right? The Dunning-Kruger effect, I think, is like it's a poster for my life, because, you know, you meet so many people in the beginning, because you can tell right away, right? They, and nothing against new trainers, but they know everything, right? There's one way to do things, and it's all I like to do this, and I enjoy doing this for clients, and this is what I think and kind of I feel, and not that there's anything wrong with that, but I think as you start to investigate, right, and you start climbing down the rabbit hole, right, you start to realize how much you don't know, right? Not in a bad way, but how complex the body is, right? It starts with counting to 10 and trying to lift really heavy. And then you start to investigate, well, we can't lift heavy forever, right? Because we're not ants and we can't bench press 10 times our body weight. And then from there, we start to go, okay, well, how do I make myself better, right? And then we start to get into the overload things and in the volume training. And then you know, past that, we start to identify, oh, your body's aware of what we do every day in the gym, right? You know that if you do a 6-week program, by 6 weeks, your body literally knows that we're going to go in the gym and do pull-ups, and then we're going to go do this shoulder press thing afterwards. And it starts to kind of understand the direction we're going, or the order of operations that we're doing in the gym. And then it becomes a psychological thing. And there's just, you know, I can go on and on and on, but there's just so much stuff that your body kind of figures out as we go, you know, through these things. And then I think as a coach, you start to realize what works well for you, right? And then what kind of you like to do, because everybody's like, oh, I bet you work out all the time and it's amazing and you have all these changes. And I said, well, at this point in my life, I do it for psychological reasons, right? It's not really, let's break my bench press record. It's more of, I do that movement because it helps with my shoulders, but then I go out and run because if I'm having a day where you're not that good, or, you know, kind of you're down on energy, I know that going outside for a jog or a run or something like that is going to increase my energy. But I think that's just a great story. Same as you know, outside all the time as well, and constantly being away, right? It's kind of, you know, caveman like now, that we used to write a note on the kitchen table and then you would go outside, and we had no cell phones and none of your friends had a nickel to rub together. And we just went outside and did whatever. And then we just came home before it was dark out. And if we were going to be late, you would find a pay phone or borrow your friend's house phone. And you would call your parents and say, this is where I am. And this is when I'm going to be home. And now that's a whole different, that's kind of that's a lost art, if you will, I think.
Yeah, I would have to agree. It's the importance of play cannot be underscored enough. It's just, it's something that the human body needs. You look at every mammal on this planet and there is youthful play, and it's part of brain development. It's part of physical development. It's something that we truly are. It's part of our evolution and our growth. So it makes you kind of scratch your head and wonder the type of play that is currently occurring due to technological advances, whether it's video games or smartphones with the games on them, or just the single sport athletes. There's so many things in today's culture that have drawn us away from simply going out your door and going to climb a tree or going to play down. For me, I lived right on the edge of the Boston and Maine Railroad. And so there was a rail line, and there was a great place to go explore when you're a kid, you know, just throwing rocks at empty bottles under the bridge, or going down and trying to balance on the rails and seeing how far you can go, or running on the ties and skipping one. Or it was just great natural kind of athletic ability in development just by going out and playing. So yeah, I'm a curious observer as to how that today's culture, how that's going to trickle down into tomorrow's adults of the how the kids are playing today.
Yeah, absolutely. There's the book Play. I haven't got a chance to read it yet, but I have clients that have read it, and it talks about that very thing, you know, adults and how you should always keep that kind of childlike spunk and try to kind of sprinkle it into your, you know, your life on a weekly basis or a daily basis, because, you know, I think on the back end too, it's very good for brain development in the beginning, but also I think it keeps the brain and the plasticity and the growing and the creation of new neurons, you know, in there as well as we get older. So I think it's a very important point to make sure that you're doing things like that, right? And not necessarily, you know, playing with blocks or having a food fight, but just enjoying yourself, right? And not kind of putting pressure on yourself to be an adult all the time, right? Within reason, you know, go outside and have fun. And much like yourself, what you just brought up, I'm very concerned too of what the video games and the, you know, the less social engagement person to person is going to do. I had a conversation with somebody a few weeks ago about how, you know, when you were a young kid, you would go to your friend's house and you would knock on the door and their adult parent would come to the door and you'd have to ask, hey, Mrs. So-and-so, can Johnny or, you know, Billy come out and play? And that's a lost art, right? We had to, at 5 years old or whatever time, you had to be an adult, right? We had to go to the door and knock on the door. And then somebody that we didn't really know would come to the door. And then we'd have to have a conversation with them, even though they were, you know, years above us. And I think little things like that as well, losing it, it's going to be very, you know, I don't know if it's going to be strange or weird, but to see what happens, because little things like that are now, you know, disappearing. And just like you said, running around outside, right? Getting in fights with each other, right? Playing all these sports, right? I grew up, we lived, you know, with the winter stuff. We used to play a form of ice hockey in a pond. And the way we tested the ice was we took a really big rock and we threw it in the air. And if it landed and you didn't go through, we could play. And if somebody fell through, it was, hey, don't go over there because so-and-so fell through there last week. So we've identified that as thin ice. So just little things like that. I don't think the screens are going to help well with that thing. And I think too, that the single sport athletes, right. I read a post yesterday on Instagram that Michael Jordan played baseball, football, ran track and basketball in, you know, in high school and things like that. And I think we're getting away from that. And I think you can see that in the early development. And I also think, if you are a single sport athlete and you end up at a high level, I think your progression is limited because I think your patterns that weren't developed as a young kid playing other sports that you didn't develop at an early age or what get exposed as an early age. If you're, you know, one sport or you kind of put all your efforts into one movement.
Agreed. I couldn't agree more. Yeah. It's just the single sport athlete, we could talk at length about this, but there's patterns that emerge in that sport that are great, but other activities, I mean, just simply the events of track and field can carry over greatly to almost any sport you can imagine. So it just makes more sense. Now, of course, I actually had a guest on my podcast not too long ago, and we were talking about this, and he is a coach, strength coach for professional track athletes in the US, and just left LSU. And we're talking about the fact that the single sport athlete is being promoted, unfortunately, because of tuition hikes in colleges and parents maybe not able to afford the tuition, but if they get a scholarship. And so there's this underlying machine that's helping encourage the single sport athlete that we might want to look at as well. It's not just the kid that just wants to play this or the overzealous parent that really wants to get them that scholarship. There's more to it. But I think just simply put, if we can get outside and play, turn off the screen and just go do something, and it's okay to be bored also. You don't have to be constantly bombarded by stimuli all the time. There's something to be said about a downtime. All professional athletes have an off season. We should have an off button. So we need to down regulate all the stimuli that's continually bombarding us. So I really like it when my kids get bored. They're not in the best mood, but there's something to be said for the fact that, oh, okay, you don't feel like you feel like you always have to be doing something, but yeah, it's okay to be accustomed to not having something to do.
Yeah, absolutely. I think that's a phenomenal point. It's okay to be that way, right? You to be able to figure things out, because I you know, that affirmation or stuff to do all the time, right? I think that also leads into what we talked about with the singular stuff, right? You have kids that they play on 14 travel teams and they work out 5 times a week, and then they have a sports specific coach or something going on. And I think that's from, they always need to do something, right? You can't just rest. I mean, even I've seen it, and I'm sure you have with coaches, right? They'll come into the weight room at some point and be like, why are people standing around? Why aren't we working out or moving the entire time we're in here for the entire hour? And I'm like, well, this is called rest. And in order to get a stimulus, we kind of, you know, we need those things. But I think it's a constant, you know, this thing where everybody has to do stuff all the time, right? And then again, you talked about the money, right? The college is getting very expensive. And if you don't get a scholarship, you know, then, you know, maybe you can't go to the school you want, or maybe your career might end. And I think that plays a major role as well. I mean, you have, I know now in a few high schools that are bigger, they don't encourage playing multiple sports, right? There's the risk of injury and all these other things. So I love the point you brought up where it's just not, you know, the parents pushing, and it's not the kid, I want to play this one thing. The kids growing up are kind of, they're pushed into, oh, well, I want to get a scholarship. And then so-and-so is very good at this place. So what did they do? Oh, they ate, slept and drank, you know, baseball or football. And I think everything goes into it, right? So I think in order for these things to change too, something has to change there at the top, especially now, you know. And I do agree with the players getting paid, but the likeness thing, I think we do it a lot where we go overboard, right? We have a good idea to fix a problem, and then instead of saying, okay, everybody gets a salary, or we split up the likeness thing, it's okay, the person on the magazine now gets the $9 million or gets sponsored by Lululemon. And that is I think is going to cause a problem. I mean, I know of a school over here where a kid was supposed to go to a particular school and he was all set. And then he got an offer from a company to make some money. And instead of going through his senior year, he ended up leaving school early, went to the said school he was supposed to go to. And that caused a lot of problems at the school because they weren't ready for him to come. And then he ended up going somewhere else. So again, you're already starting to see it as a negative effect on the kids, because I completely get it. If you're in the 12th grade and Nike comes out and says, we'll give you $9 million your freshman year, if you can graduate early, we'll give you money now. You know, those are hard decisions to make. So I think those are definitely something to take into account, where they are big decisions, right? If I play one sport, I can make a lot of money. Or if I singularize one sport and then maybe not play as long, and but I can be a brand ambassador, right? These are things that that come along, because you can, you know, the money changes your life. And I think that's always an important aspect to think about.
Agreed. Yeah, I can't. Yeah, like I said, we could talk about this quite a bit. I think in a nutshell, though, as strength coaches, it falls upon our shoulders in part to be responsible for having conversations with not only the athlete, but with the athlete and their family, with the coaches, that the sport coaches, and just imparting hopefully a little suggestion that in order for them to be a better athlete, we need to change up their patterns so that they become much more universal in their ability to move. And that means that star basketball player you have, I actually need him to go out for track, or I need him to play some ultimate frisbee, or I think it would be really good if he did some baseball or softball. And the reason being is that it will help with power production. It will help with three-dimensionality of movement. It will allow the body to reduce the wear and tear of repetitive movements on the body. And it will help to kind of bulletproof that athlete and just enhance their game and their ability that much more.
Absolutely. So, I couldn't agree more. I think that's, I think in order to change, that is now our responsibility, right? To use it and have conversations and make them understand the importance of those other movements to make them better at the overall goal, instead of saying, you know, because you do have some where you, oh yeah, the one sport, right? You need to work on your craft all the time, nonstop. But I think that's a very, very important Point you bring up, and I think that is very important for strength coach to do. Yes, having conversation, communication, and making the athlete understand, listen, I'm going to need you to go out and play soccer. It's going to make you a better defender on the basketball court, or let's go run some short sprints on the track team. We'll learn form. And then in retrospect, we'll be better running down the football field. So I think that is a phenomenal piece of advice. And I think you're right. In order for it to change, it's going to fall on the backs of the strength coaches for us to be more informative, more educational, but also to make sure that we keep our mind open in terms of our toolbox and always making sure that it's not only, in the weight room and the movements, but also we can still suggest, let's go out and run a season of track or let's go play some lacrosse or something along those lines.
Yeah, and I think you bring up a good point in mentioning the toolbox. I mean, within our program design, there's going to be many different elements that are going to demand things from the body, whether it's more flexibility or pliability, whether it's strength or power, whether it's coordination or accuracy or balance. There's a whole bunch of different endurance. There's different things that we want to train into our clients, into our athletes, and those are, at one point in time, it was primarily strength. We were very biased or centered around strength training as the only tool that's going to help every athlete. We may change the strength exercises based on their performance and based on their moves. But then we started to say, strength isn't really everything. We should kind of give a few more pieces of the pie into this mix here. And I know that if I got that joint moving a little bit better, well, that would actually increase their strength. So I don't need to do the overload principle on everything. Maybe if I got that body moving, got the brain responding and all these other things, wouldn't I've got a more complete athlete. And it's the same with different sports or different movements. We can't just assume that this baseball player is going to be a phenomenal baseball player just simply by having that be their only sport. I need them to do other movements. And so that piece of pie hopefully will shrink and allow other wedges to get in there to make a more complete athlete.
Yeah, absolutely. I can't agree more. Making sure the toolbox, again, making sure we're developing complete athletes and not getting caught, because I think it does happen, everybody. When you do it for a long time, right? I catch myself sometimes when you write programs, you start to narrow a little bit, right? You start to write things and then you take a step back and look and say, oh, well, we haven't really done lateral movement in a little while, right? Or we're predominantly in the sagittal plane, or we've kind of overdone the frontal plane and things of that sort of rotational. And, I think it's always a key to take a step back, right? And always make sure we're kind of doing a check, if you will, with ourselves, every 4 or 6 weeks or whatever, as we have programs going, because, it's based on your particular sport, or if you're in a facility that trains a wide variety, right? When you have your busy seasons, you start to get in kind of a groove where you're writing programs and we're progressing things, right? And we always want to go to the strength part, but I think it's a very important, aspect to always take a step back and say, okay, let's look at everybody's programs and let's kind of write down all the movements we're doing and then kind of break that down off to the side and say, okay, the last 2 months we've been doing a lot of sagittal, a lot of frontal stuff. Let's incorporate a little bit more of the transverse plane, right? Or we haven't really done a lot of running form on a, on a lateral basis or anything like that. We've been doing a lot of bilateral. Let's change into unilateral. So I think it's very important kind of having a check all the time just to make sure we're developing that complete athlete.
Yes. Yeah, I agree. Like every movement, it should be looked at as an assessment, and every assessment is a movement. They go hand in hand. So if you know what you're hoping to see, what you're looking for, and somebody executes a movement and that's not happening, well, that's going to give you good insight and information as to what needs to be done. Okay, why isn't this happening? Now I've got to follow these clues to get to the core reason what's going on with this body, right? And so we've been on this kick, I would say, since the early 2000s, all about corrective exercise. And at one point, the pendulum swung so far that everyone was, that's all they were doing with their clients was corrective, corrective, corrective. And they were getting away from the strength and conditioning and what the person truly needed. They were trying to clean up everything they could. And it was good. I mean, the pendulum needs to swing and we need to have movement, but hopefully it comes back around a center where honestly, everything in a way could be viewed as through a corrective lens. Every program that you design could be that way, but it doesn't mean that we have to always have somebody laying on the ground with a foam roller underneath or doing this stretch and for the entire hour. I mean, there's a whole bunch of loaded movements with strength. There's a whole bunch of endurance. There's a whole bunch of speed, agility, and quickness, but we could use it in corrective manners. So we're constantly trying to direct the athlete in a way that becomes the goal being the most optimal level of performance that anyone can achieve. So, yeah, I don't know if I ran off on a tangent there, but I recall like there were times where you go to conferences and everyone was just taking all this time about correctives and you're just scratching your head going, okay, well, if you're going to correct it, shouldn't you see what it's corrected? Shouldn't you be putting that into play rather than just trying to correct something and say, okay, your session's done. So.
Oh yeah, absolutely. And no, that's not a tangent. I always love to think about it because, you know, I noticed the same thing because it seems like we always have to have a label, right? What is corrective exercise? Well, corrective exercise is only these things, right? Where I love you bring out, you know, I'm a Louis Simmons, you know, RIP, but the optimal part, right? When I started listening to him about 15 years ago, I love the optimal, right? What's optimal for our client? What's optimal for our athlete, right? And a corrective exercise necessarily for one person might not fall in a corrective exercise kind of label, but, you know, a deep squat with a kettlebell for some tight hips, right? And adding a little weight to that and maybe helping them get into a deeper range and kind of helping maybe alleviate some hip labrum pain or increasing, you know, QL involvement or maybe getting some more flexion in the spine. I think that is something that we should try to go to, right? Because exactly, we label everything. Oh, everything's a corrective, right? Or this is the only thing that's these exercises that are in the NASM book for the corrective cert or only fall under correctives, where in reality, it's let's look at the athlete, let's do assessments constantly, right? And then let's figure out what they need to make them optimal for whatever they're trying to do, whether it's, you know, you run around in the backyard with your kids and you don't want to get tired or you want to be able to reach and pick them up until they weigh 70 pounds or, you know, we're playing high level hockey. I think it's very important to make sure it's always what's optimal for our athlete. And if a movement can help something, then it can fall under a corrective category, but it's not these 20 exercises or 100 are corrective exercise and we're fixing things, right? And I always love the fact that we don't come out of the womb broken, right? Every baby, you ever see them squat down and play with blocks, right? Their squats are amazing, right? So I think it's always important to understand that at one point we could do the pattern. So we can get them back there, right? Barring any, you know, orthopedic issues or anything like that, but we can, you know, everybody's able to do that. And on top of the thing too, I think it's also very dangerous when you have younger kids labeling them as broken. Right. Okay. It's your first session. We're going to do corrective exercise now. And I think in a psychological standpoint, when you're younger, they think that something's wrong, right? Oh, we have to correct something that I did. I think, you know, I do some stuff with older adults and I think it's very cute to me, but I always hate when they do it, but they apologize, right? When they can't do movements. Oh, I'm so sorry. I couldn't, you know, go down into a squat or I'm sorry I did that wrong. And it happens all the time. And I'm like, look, you don't have to apologize, right? If I give you a movement, the best that you can give me or the best of your ability is all I ask for. And no exercise is correct, right? Yeah, there's a ideal way to do everything, but whatever range you can go in for right now is the best of your ability. And then we're going to work, but it's never their fault, right? It's not, you know, it's never something that they did on purpose, right? Nobody wakes up in the morning and for 30 years tries to destroy their patterns, right? It's work and things like that. So I always think that's something, you know, that should be brought up a lot more is that understanding that, you know, when you label things corrective or things like that, people think they're broken, right? Or this is the right way to do this.
Yeah, that's really, really well said, Joe. I don't actually use the term corrective. I mean, aside from us talking right now with this conversation, just because the listening audience understands what corrective exercise or the thought of corrective exercise. But honestly, I believe that a good coach has this lens that can turn into a microscope, but then come back and be just this wide angle lens and just turn knowing when to go in toward that microscopic viewpoint and then when to draw back and see the whole. You hear that old adage that a chain is only as strong as its weakest link. So I want to find where are those links that are weak? Can I do something to strengthen that? But then I want to pull back and I want to test the tensile strength of the whole chain now. And then I'm going to find another link that may not be as strong as the rest. And I'm going to go microscopic in there and I'm going to look and find out what's going there. And then I'm going to draw back. And that's what programs, in my vision, really should be constantly doing, is I want to drive in and I want to pull back. And I want to explore here and then I want to draw back. And I'm constantly making these adjustments, because ultimately, what I'm trying to do is get the strongest link I can possibly achieve. And sometimes what we're going to find is that that weak link is actually weak because of somewhere else down the chain. And so I'm going to focus here, but then my view is going to be drawn over to this area that may be a previous injury from 10 years gone by that has created a specific pattern of movement that has caused this other link to be really weak. And so I'm not always going to focus where the weakness is. I might draw my attention somewhere else, get this area to understand that it's no longer injured, that it can perform basic movements, that that threat that has been conditioned into the brain can be eliminated, and they can realize, wow, I can actually go there without my world ending. And then again, pull back and then test that chain's strength, and things light up like that's the strongest link they've gone so far. So yeah, the corrective, I just put that off on the shelf and just say, we're going to meet you where you are. And if you struggle to do this, that's okay. That's great insight and information. Your body is actually going to be our guide. Your body is going to tell us and show us what it needs to do. And we're going to hopefully understand that. And we're going to present it with challenges and problem-solving techniques so that we have a more efficient way of dealing with these episodes that you've experienced through your life that have caused you to move the way that you're moving currently. And we'll see if we can't clean up a few of those things and get you to move in a much more efficient manner. And the next thing you know, your brain goes, wow, this feels really much better. I think I can increase my force production in the muscles that are currently on my body. Because, you know, we hear this all the time, that's not all the time, but we only use a certain percentage of our muscular strength. There's only so much that we can really tap into. And it's based on the brain's ability to regulate how much we really need to use based on our threat levels. So if we can reduce our threat levels, our increased strength, or our strength levels will increase. So that makes me scratch my head sometimes and go, well, are we spending too much time with the weight training? And if we can get the body to move in a better way where the brain says, let's use more force in the muscles that we have, well, that's another way of doing strength training. So these days, for me personally, in my studio, I take a combination of both. We do a little strength training, a little resistance training, but we also do stuff to really unlock restricted areas, so that the force that the muscles can generate actually increase. And that reduces the wear and tear of overloading and repetitive movements. And it's turned into some remarkable results.
Yeah, absolutely. I love that, you know, the philosophy of doing it that way. And I think it's something that's not as much talked about, is how the brain is, right? They talk about, I heard a speech one time about, say you were in, you know, some sort of accident, right? And you fell asleep and you were in a coma for years, right? And you worked at a grocery store, and then you woke up. And when you woke up, they told you that you used to be a Navy SEAL, right? And you were the most, you know, decorated Navy SEAL, and you were a badass, right? Your life after that injury or waking up from that would be 100% different than it used to be, right? Because now your brain has gotten rid of, not that working at a grocery store is bad, but gotten rid of that mentality. And now somebody said, hey, you're a Navy SEAL now. So you're going to live your life from that point on in a whole different way, think about things in a whole different way, and probably do a lot more or accomplish a lot more things that you used to. And I think it kind of relies to what we're talking about, is that if if your brain thinks that you can only move in a certain way, or you can only apply this much force in a certain movement, we're actually holding the body back. And I think that you can increase all of this, but you have to get into that nitty gritty stuff. You have to identify where those issues are in the joint, or where the issues are down the road from injuries and things. And then we have to train the brain and the body again to be okay with that, right? You hear it all the time. Well, I can't squat because I have bad knees, or I can't lunge because it's bad for this because 12 years ago, I, you know, my patella slipped to the side and I've had knee pain ever since. Right. And I think there's a lot more that goes into that instead of avoiding that. And I think it's great. Again, what you do is when you have a studio, right, everybody out there is a coach, or when you get a new client, always making sure that you explain these things right off the bat, right? You don't want to come in and only do strength stuff for 3 months. And then all of a sudden, now we want to put in some movement stuff because now the clients are like, wait, what are we doing? Right. I signed up or this is what I thought we were going to do, all strength stuff. And now you want to go and do this movement stuff, right? I think it's always very important to kind of lay that foundation at the beginning and say, look, we're going to do a mix of strength, but we're going to do a lot of movement stuff. And we're going to get you to be the best you can be, you know, in every pattern. And then that way, also, as we progress with our strength stuff as well, anytime we have an issue where something happens or something gets tight, all we have to do is go back and kind of do two or three exercises, maybe for a few weeks or whatever, and then we're right back to where we are. I think that doing that and constantly incorporating that in our programs, regardless if you train athletes or the general pop, it's important to implement those things early, because I think the hardest thing is either you get somebody who comes from a strictly strength-based program, or in the beginning, you put them on strictly strength-based stuff. And then when things do happen, now they look at it as a limiting factor. Oh, I was squatting 450 and now my hip hurts and now I can't. And then that's the end of it. Instead of saying, well, you know, we're going to squat 135 for a week or two, but we're going to do mobility in the hip or the knee, you know, and get that open for a week. Remember, we did those exercises in the beginning and we'll be right back to whatever that weight is.
Yeah. Yeah. Well said. I think for me also, the importance of trying to understand what their history is, yep, leads to a lot of information. Not that you have to know, because there's going to be some things that people don't recall, remember, and they may be actually quite traumatic and they've blocked it out, which has been an experience of mine with several clients over the years. But to understand how the brain is negotiating movement with the rest of the body is really a good insight or a tool of knowledge that a strength coach may want to pursue, because the brain's fundamental priority is survival. Without it, we don't exist. That it controls, it's our overall governing body to all the systems that make us up. And the brain needs fuel and activation as its primary source of survival. And the brain is going to try and regulate enough fuel for its survival, which means that any movement that takes more energy than necessary is something that the brain is not necessarily going to want to do, but may be forced to do it in order to get around previous injuries or surgeries or accidents or whatever. But the cool thing, Joe, is that the brain is very binary. The area of the brain that helps regulate this, it goes by ones and zeros. So it chooses something that may not be as efficient as it could be, and it creates a pattern of that, and that pattern becomes normalized to overcome like an inversion sprain at an ankle or a low back tweak or a whiplash from a car accident. There's a new way that the body is going to start to move, and that will normalize over time. And all the gym exercise you can think of are assuming that the body is going to be just like the anatomy chart shows, perfectly balanced and everything. But that's not going to be the case in these situations. So now we've got these compensatory patterns that are going to be further exacerbated with load and resistance. But if we knew the original issue of what the brain's trying to do in its regards to negotiating around these limitations, and we actually taught it how to do something more efficient, the brain's going to go, whoa, that's way better. Let's do that more often. And if we can repeat that with our clients on a regular basis, we'll start to see different movement patterns emerge. And we'll actually see a lot of chronic and acute issues in the tissues, so to speak, start to become mitigated or eliminated. And so the role of strength coach or personal trainer has now expanded, not into physical therapy. We're not therapists. We're not treating. We're just offering new ways to negotiate movement. And if we can understand how the body moves and we can observe what's happening there, then then our eyes and our mouth become some of the most important, powerful tools we can have in our toolbox.
Oh, absolutely. Yes. I think that the brain and having understanding of the brain as a strength coach is the most important thing. And I think, you know, like you said, getting to know everybody, it's very important, right? I mean, I've been around trainers that train people for 3, 4 years and they're like, oh, I didn't know they hurt their knee in the 11th grade. And not that it's a negative, but I'm like, how do you not know that? I mean, you know, it's a consistent pattern that happens, right? You can see it all the time. And I had the conversation with somebody the other day, you know, they were talking about, well, I want to get into this with this shape and do this, but certain times with my mind. And I said, look, your brain doesn't identify a six pack and, you know, 8% body fat as something it wants to do. All your brain cares about is you surviving. I said, so that is why sometimes you have limitations or there's certain things, because as you said, it's survival. Your brain doesn't care if your six pack showing you look nice in a bathing suit. Your brain identifies, okay, today we have this much energy and this is all we have. And we have to run all these complex systems. And then as we do activities, your brain says, okay, we have a little bit left or we have this. And then with the patterns, you know, if we walk this way and we place our foot on the ground and we, you know, evert, right, that hurts. So we're going to walk on the inside, and all your brain wants to do is eliminate pain. And if something hurts long enough and those signals get bigger and bigger up there, it's going to say, okay, we're going to primarily walk on the inside of our foot, because when we roll over and put pressure on the lateral side of the foot, you know, we have pain. So I think that's a great thing to bring up, that these are the things we have to identify. That is why we have to go down the rabbit hole when we get clients. What happened, right? We want to know everything that goes in. Again, you said, you know, if there's trauma or it's something, especially since when injuries are new, I think we have to be very careful. But in order to offer the best to our athletes and our clients, very important to get to those things, because the brain, again, you know, equal, what is it? The fastest distance between two points is straight line, right? Your brain is going to, it's not going to tell you can't do this, but it's going to say, okay, how can we do this movement without any pain, right? And identifies pain or discomfort as a bad thing. And it just wants to avoid that. It doesn't know that certain things are good or bad. And I think the more we dial into that, or the better we can change that pattern and show the brain a better way and a more efficient way, because that's all it cares about: homeostasis and efficiency.
Yeah. You know, and to carry that a little bit further, to try and have a little paradigm shift in thinking. It's like somebody comes in and say, oh, well, I have this, well, like that person that you gave an example, you know, I injured my knee in 11th grade and now I've shifted my weight down on my foot to avoid the pain. We'll carry that further down the road. That pattern has become normalized, and that shifting has changed the position of the hips and pelvis to the point where now the back has to try to organize over the tilted or rotated hips. And now it has to pull a little bit to try and to maintain some semblance of balance. So one side of the muscles down the spine are having to shorten while the other ones are lengthening, and then one shoulder may be slightly higher than the other because of that tilting action, and then the skull has to tilt to try and balance off to stay level with the horizon. And the next thing you know, this person's really complaining of neck pain or back pain or ACL tear. I mean, the outcome can be a whole myriad of possibilities. But when people come in and they say, oh, yeah, and I've got a back problem, what if you thought, instead of a problem, you thought that was the solution? Like, your brain is trying to figure out the best way to get around something that occurred. And now its solution is actually creating some pain over time. But it's not the problem. And I think that's one of the things that we fall prey to, is somebody comes in and says, I have knee pain. And what's the first thing we go to is the knee. Mm-hmm. When in fact, maybe we just, before you jump right to the knee, maybe you just kind of just maybe look at the whole body and see what's going on. And yeah, you want to bring your attention to the knee. Of course, that would be negligent to some degree if you didn't kind of look at that. But it could be that knee is doing too much because somewhere else isn't doing enough. Could we get that other area to perform the way that it should? And then the next thing you know, I didn't even do anything with that knee and it feels so much better. Well, then is it really a knee problem? No, it was just a solution. So can we create a new solution? Can we find a new way? And and I know this kind of reverts back into correctives, and I'm not saying that. It's what it does is it provides you with the movements that the person needs. And it could be weight bearing. It could be strength training. It could be actually endurance or soft tissue. It could be mobility, flexibility. It gives you an avenue now to actually set your sights on instead of what we've learned with most certification processes for strength coaches and personal trainers, that it's not a cookie cutter approach where we're just going to give them these lifts and expect every goodness to come out of this. Everyone's going to be different. Everyone has a unique fingerprint. Everyone has a unique movement pattern. So you've got to appreciate that and realize that one program is not going to solve everyone's problems.
Absolutely. And again, I think bringing up the correctives, again, it's when you were talking about everybody getting caught, that's what happened. Everybody tried to use correctives to make everybody look like Leonardo da Vinci's model instead of saying, okay, your knee hurts because your back is, you know, because your hips are out of line and therefore because you tore your labrum in your shoulder on the other side, right? I always think it's, you know, very interesting. You see people with canes a lot of the times, right? What happens? On the side that you have the cane, the other side, there's a knee brace, right? And it kind of just climbs up the chain, right? I remember in biomechanics in school, we always used to talk about, you know, it's as simple as if you jam your finger, right? Well, now when I open up a doorknob, I have to change the grip on the doorknob, right? And then it travels up my hand, and then my flexor tendons and my extensors and my wrist get tight. And then there all of a sudden my shoulder hurts. We start to drop our shoulder, and then it goes on the other side. And then the QL is overstretched and it travels all the way down. And before we know it, we broke two fingers, but now my left knee hurts and I ended up breaking my finger on the right side. So I think it's very important to bring that up and understand that, you know, everything is, it's a solution, right? Well, what actually happened? Well, it's not your knee. It's you broke your two fingers on the other side, right? But I think it's, you know, we always try to, that self-admiration we were talking about, right? With the technology and the phones and everything else. I think that's one of the things that happens is it's, okay, I just want to fix my knee on the left side, right? Instead of digging deep and then going to that other side. But again, circling and coming back to the correctives, using the exercises, again, I don't use correctives either, but using that knowledge to help fix and get rid of the knee pain and then kind of get them back to where they're comfortable and where the brain now identifies doing normal movements and then adding the strength. Because as you said, and I love that, everybody's unique in the way they are, right? Everybody's born is kind of like snowflakes, right? When they fall from the sky, everybody has different patterns, different joint articulations. You know, your scapula sit different, your femur sits in the hip joint different. But if we can get everybody to move without pain or limited pain and then be able to do, you know, your basic movements, I think that's where we need to use correctives and not turning it into an entire thing. Because again, you're not a physical therapist, but also you can't do that. I mean, you can take every person, if you tried to fix everything, I don't even know if you could legit do it, if you wanted to measure everybody and get their joints back to normal. I think there's very few people that you would be, oh, okay, yep, everything's at you know, 0 degrees.
Yeah, agreed. And I think that if we have just a better understanding of what we're just speaking of, I have a feeling that it's happening. It's starting to trickle into the ranks of athletic conditioning. And I think potentially a little into the general population, but I think we'll see less non-contact injuries when it comes to sports or everyday life, if we can start to look at it in that realm. But, you know, that's a hard road to climb in a way, because where we've come from in our Western approach to strength conditioning has revolved around powerlifting, bodybuilding, and Olympic lifting. That's where we got all of our gym exercises from. We threw away the gymnasiums of the late 1800s and early 1900s, and a few things have come back. You know, rings, climbing ropes, ladders to some degree, stall bars and whatnot. But for the most part, most gyms are just flooded with a whole bunch of equipment that is really good for bodybuilders and that is really good for powerlifters. And of course, with the onset of CrossFit in 2000, Olympic lifting has just gone through the roof. But all of these are competition lifts, and with one frame, one purpose in mind. With bodybuilding, it's the aesthetic qualities of the body and how nice can I look in a bathing suit on stage with tanning oils and whatnot. Powerlifting is just how much can I lift, like gross force production. And Olympic lifting is how much can I throw over my head. That's it. And none of them are necessarily thinking about how well do my joints move with one another? How well do I have proper movement patterns or anything else? Compared to, say, martial arts, yoga, Tai Chi, those things actually take into consideration what I just mentioned. So it's really, it's going to take a little bit of unlearning and reimagining in our industry to come around and integrate those type of Eastern movement practices and philosophies into our Western approach. I believe it's happening. I see it already happening, but it's just, we're such in our infancy in our industry that we've only been, I mean, with personal training and strength coaching, late 70s, 80s, maybe at best. So here we are, maybe 30, 40 years into an industry. It's very, very young. And so it's exciting at the same time, because there's so much more potential for maturity, and that's happening. And with guys like yourself and exploring these on your podcast and sharing that with your listening audience, I think that's just a great way of sending that message out there and letting them know, you know, it's more than just a barbell. It's more than just a stretch cord too. It's more than just going out for a run. So
yeah, absolutely.
That's my soapbox moment right there.
Yeah, but exactly. I mean, you know, that's what I want to do with the podcast is the information, because I think it's important. It is growing, right? And it's always nice to see. I think the part that's hard is because it's I think the way that it's always been matched is some athlete somewhere at an extremely high level is going to have to train with those philosophies. That's usually what happens, because you'll have somebody that does something, right? And then something will be around for years, and then all of a sudden something happens, right? We can take, but I don't want to talk too long, but vegan, right? Vegan's a big thing, because what happens? You get guys in the UFC that all of a sudden they were vegan for, you know, the fight in which they won the championship, right? Or they did some sort of different training, and then now this is the philosophy. And I think that's what kind of takes on, right? It's an unfortunate thing, in my opinion, but that's what happens at high level sports. Is usually it's some philosophy or different things. It has to be done by a high level athlete, and then they have to be successful, and then they have to talk about it, right? I mean, you take the TB12, you know, everybody's like, oh, do you know about that? Yes, I read the book, right? I love the stuff. But if you break it down at a core level, it's, you know, activation, right? Lots of vitamins, being hydrated, lots of electrolytes, right? Making sure your diet is on point, and then pretty much integrating activation with lifting, and then kind of getting away, or excuse me, resistance moving, not really lifting. And then from there, we kind of address movements on a daily basis. And if we have something that's caught, or, you know, the range of motion isn't there, we kind of do more to get blood flow and identify that for the brain. And then we use exercises to increase the range of motion, and kind of getting away from the weights, right? But again, that works for Tom Brady. And Tom Brady, I don't have to, you know, we could talk all day about what Tom Brady's accomplished, but it at a root level, it's not some big, huge, confusing program, right? It's very simple, but the stuff that they do is very complex in a way, because they're just addressing his movement patterns on a daily basis.
Yeah, Alex has created a great kind of system there. And it takes into consideration a whole bunch of stuff that we've already talked on. Soft tissue work, pliability, flexibility, proper loading, multi-directional movements. It's refreshing, because it's things like that that are percolating to the surface. And when you have high profile athletes like Tom, it definitely carries over. They're opening up a new facility in New York. They've got it in Boston and Tampa. I mean, it's starting to spread out a little bit more, and obviously it's got some credibility as well. I think, though, it's really quite interesting you bring up the plant-based or vegan. I, I think, Joe, really what it is it we, I don't want to always go back to the brain, but the brain does not like stagnancy. It doesn't, it needs change. It needs stimulation. And that's why if you've got a juice company in your neighborhood, they always have to come up with new juice flavors. Mm-hmm. They've always got to kind of just tweak the recipe. Now we're incorporating boysenberry. Oh, now it's the acai berry, or now it's going to be whatever. We're going to put in Jerusalem artichokes next. It's got to be something that we're always having to be stimulated. And I think that's the same thing with just about everything when it comes to like eating plans, nutrition, diets, whatever you want to call them. They're always going to be changing. But there's going to be something at the core center that holds true, that almost all of them are going to agree upon or have. And it's the same thing with conditioning programs. There's going to be certain core elements. And of course, we can tweak this area and that area, and then we can call it some type of diet or some type of training system. But ultimately, there are certain truths that we cannot escape. You know, that we need fuel and we need hydration. How we get that, who knows? There's a whole bunch of ways. We need movement. How do we get that? Who knows? There's a whole bunch of ways. There's certain things that are always going to ring true. So if we can just remember that and circle around the truths and have our world basically orbiting around there, that's wonderful. I laugh at the California yoga craze. And it's been going on for quite a long time, but really it's taken off in the last 20 years, where there are more different styles of yoga than there are flavored ice creams at a Baskin Robbins. It is crazy. And are we going to see, we see superheated rooms. We've got several nearby that get them up into 100+ degrees, and then you're going to exercise there. I'm sure somebody's going to build a giant igloo and say, no, we're doing yoga in sub-freezing temperatures. And we're going to take the Wim Hof approach to yoga. You know, it's so fun to be an observer of it and not be critical necessarily, just be observing, going, okay, there must be some good in all of these things. Can we pick out what those ingredients are and just go, oh, that makes sense. Maybe I can learn from that. I don't know. It's just an exciting time that we are just, there's so many things that are trying to mature and yet we're still in a toddler phase. So it's interesting to just take that perspective.
Oh, absolutely. I don't know if you have something works, but we have them around here where it's, you get a membership and you enter a code and all the rooms are heated and you go and do TRXs or spin cycle or rowing. You go online and you schedule it, and there's, it's pretty much, if you know, there's a code, or I think it's a wand or something like that, and you go in there and all the rooms are heated, and you can play with the temperature, and they're at 100 degrees, and there's weights in there, and they're little, they're almost the size of a sauna, maybe a little bit bigger, and you go in there and you work out in the heat and stuff like that. But I think, you know, what you said is very important, is to understand that everybody wants change, right? It's always the new thing, right? Because you could get away with doing similar things all the time, but everybody wants change. And I think instead of looking at it as a negative, like you said, look at it as a positive. What can we take from everything, right? Yoga at its base level is phenomenal, right? Whether you do it in an igloo and that's probably going to happen, because I'm sure, well, you know, in 2 years or something, somebody's going to be like, oh, we're going to be doing cryo yoga or whatever, right? And you fill the room with liquid nitrogen and you go through your poses and all these things, and the goal is to keep your body temperature at 97 or something, and then you wear a thermometer and everything else. I can just see it now, you know, with the whole thing. But I think it's important to, you know, we talked about it before, that scope, right? Bringing it in and kind of zeroing in the microscope, and then going back to 20 times visibility, and then coming back to one. If everybody in agreement and just take things from everything that comes out, right? Instead of looking at it as, oh, this is so much, or these things are stupid, right? Or same thing I've heard all the time, oh, CrossFit's stupid. I'm like, well, it's not stupid, right? If you take it for where it is, CrossFit turned weightlifting into a competition, and what it's done for the field is it's put it on television, and now everybody does it. So it gets more people involved in you know, in fitness and interested. And then now it's on television. And then, you know, people ask more questions about exercises because I think they do a great job of adding new things and taking out some things and whatever, or emphasizing certain movements. But the point of it is just always be open-minded. If we can all learn to take everything from everybody, right? If you have a yoga studio and there might be 30 different ways, but maybe you can add certain movements, or same thing with strength conditioning. If you have somebody who's all power and all velocity-based training and TENS units, what can we take from that to make the people that we train better, right? Instead of, I think we have too many divisions in, oh, well, if you like this or X, Y, and Z, then you're over here and that's correctives, or we don't lift. Or if you like to only lift with cables, though, you need to lift, you need to use dumbbells and you need to deadlift every day. Instead of saying, okay, how can any of this make me better, right? What about these new philosophies can make you, you know, make everybody better or make my clients better? Or even if you don't use them, understanding that, I think that what you brought up is understanding the purpose of what everybody is trying to do, right? We're just trying to come up with new and exciting ways to get people to move. And then your brain is like, oh, this is great. We've never done this before, right? And I like this. So, you know, it's going to release more endorphins and more dopamine when we do those things and get you more excited, as opposed to if we went to a dingy gym back in the day with no windows and we had barbells and dumbbells and everything like that.
Yeah, I think one of the best things as a coach that you can continually do is just simply ask why. To everything you do through the day, every movement you suggest to a client or athlete, you just got to put why in front of that. Okay, why do I want to do this? And if it fits into your desired goal and what you're hoping the outcome will be, then that is a great compass needle. Just that simple question, why? Why am I doing this? Is it because I have more time than I know what to do with, and I'm just trying to fill space? Well, you might want to rethink that. You know, it allows you to just maintain a good direction. And rather than, and if you ask why, well, it's because I saw this awesome thing on YouTube this guy was doing, or, oh, this Instagram post I just saw, and this woman was doing this. Like, that may not be the best answer either. It helps for me if I maintain that practice of asking why. It just keeps my path a little bit more true.
Yeah, absolutely. I think that's a great piece of advice. Great book, by the way, as well. But yeah, just identifying why people do that, or trying to even understand, right? Even if you see it on Instagram and you can't talk to the person, why are they doing this, right? And I think, you know, to go beyond with your clients, right? Always making sure that they understand your why, and always understand your why and theirs kind of match up, right? Well, why are we doing this exercise, right? Always explaining things, right? And always making sure that the people you train, they understand why you do everything you do. That way, when you change things, right, in the program, or we can maybe go over to new movements, they know that everything is what they want, right? And if you continuously ask why, it keeps you on accountability, right? Where I think sometimes too, we get that separation where it's do this because I'm on my soapbox and you're the client and I know more than you, right? Whereas I think as a positive, if you always had to explain why and always asked why as well, it's always why as the coach am I having my client do this? What is the really, you know, down to that base level we talked about, why am I doing this, right? And then explain to the client, well, this is what you wanted to do, or this was your goal, and not to look like Instagram, but, you know, once you get down to a niche of a goal of something deep in there, this is exactly how we're doing this exercise because it fits directly in what you want and it's going to help directly. Here's the goal, right? And then here's all the little, you know, the lines that connect it directly to what you're doing. And it creates that beautiful relationship. Also, it allows the entire program, if you will, grow, right? I always look at it when you get a new client or an athlete, you put the seed in the dirt, right? And you cover it, but then you and the athlete are watering it and giving it sunlight and everything else. And it's only going to grow with the both of you, right? It's not, I tell you what to do and then you just blindly go do it. And it's also not you decide or you tell me what you want to do. It's a constant balance, almost like a ballet or an orchestra of this is, I take my expertise and, you know, I'm going to help you here. But then I also want as much feedback from you as well, because I want to make sure that everything is there. But every time we change programs or everything we do, you know that there's an exact reason why we're doing this. And there's no kind of, we're just doing this because, or because it was on TV or it's written in a textbook and I like the author.
Yeah. The why, explaining the why is what brings the buy-in. That's just, and the path of education to your client, because so often they're coming in with certain expectations of what the training is probably going to look like. And that's part in part, maybe from how their friends or relatives who have used trainers in the past have gone through, or what they see in social media or training. It may not be accurate depiction of really what you're going to be doing with them. So explaining the why is really a critical ingredient to developing the buy-in, an educational path for them. And it gives you value. You know, they get to see, okay, this guy, this woman, really, they know their stuff. So.
Absolutely. I just want to switch a little bit and just talk about, you know, the books and writing the books and just explain kind of how you got into writing, right? What sparked the writing? You know, I know you did a little bit in college, right? It was kind of something you did, but how did you, you know, how did you transition to writing books and what kind of sparked the idea? Was it more, you know, just getting your knowledge out there? Or was it something where you had no desire to writing a book ever? And then it just kind of happened through your experiences and through your time with training?
Oh, good question. So University of Massachusetts, I was not a kinesiology major, nothing with exercise science. I think I took one class at that time and didn't really pay attention. So most of my information education has been since the early 90s of becoming certified. But what I did get at the university was a degree in English literature. So I did a lot of writing and reading, comparative literature and so on. So, but I didn't think I wanted to be an English teacher. Of course, that was the last thing. It was just that I enjoyed those types of courses and I enjoyed writing. So fast forward to early 2000, 1999 or so, and here I am in Santa Cruz for almost 10 years. And of course, if you don't surf, you get kicked out of the city limits. That's part of the ordinance here in town. So
what about boogie boarding? Because I can't come visit.
Boogie boarding, that's okay. Boogie boarding is acceptable here as well. Body surfing, anything that's water related. But so I had been surfing for several years and growing up on the coast of New Hampshire in the summer times. Yeah, just being a water baby, basically, since an early age. So I had a studio and, you know, clients say, oh, you should do this or you should do that. You really need to. At the time, that wasn't, social media hadn't come about in 99. And not everyone had email even. And no one really had a lot of cell phones or smartphones. So books were still a means of receiving information. And I said, oh, you should write something. And you should do something about how to be a stronger surfer. And that kind of kicked it off. I looked and saw that there weren't any books that were dedicated to strength conditioning for surfing. And so I set forth a goal and determined, okay, I'm going to write a book for surfers, knowing what's involved with the sport and taking my background in strength conditioning. And that's what happened. And of course, I look back now and I cringe at the book. I think most people that write books, as soon as it goes to print, there's something you want to change. And so here we are 20 plus years later, and there's a whole bunch of things I'd like to change with that. But like we were talking earlier, there are some things that are core ingredients that are truths. And maybe not the exercises I selected for strength. I think I might change that dramatically. And there's a whole bunch of other things that I would include. But for the most part, there's a whole bunch of things that are still applicable. And then a couple of years later, I was very much into winter sports, of course, in New England, growing up that way. And then with Lake Tahoe, only a few hours away from here, I was heavily into snowboarding. And of course, that carries quite well into surfing. So surfing and snowboarding, I thought, oh, well, there you go. And somewhere in between writing the Fit to Surf book and Fit to Ski and Snowboard, in between there, I was very much growing up in the whitewater canoeing and rafting and kayaking. And I thought, well, you know, this could be a series of books. So I wrote one on paddle sports. And so those are the three that I wrote in a fairly short amount of time, like 5 or 6 years. And they're still in circulation and so on. But it wasn't for probably about 15 years later that I thought, well, maybe it's time to rewrite those books and put out second editions with the amount of information that I have gained and the knowledge that people have shared with me over these last couple of decades. So I got set to doing that. But then my wife started reading my draft, and she said, "This isn't a rewrite. This is a completely different book. This isn't something that this is something you should really start writing for the first time and not trying to rewrite anything else." And so what transpired was my last book that I wrote, and it was released in the middle of COVID, which I don't recommend as being a good timing, but what the heck. And that was Return to Center. And that is really what I base the methodology of program design in my studio upon. It's a culmination of understanding muscular balance and posture alignment and somebody at rest standing on both feet. And how do they take that resting structure and how do they move through space? So I needed to know about gait patterns and what was involved with gait motions and gait phases. So studied that heavily for almost the last 10 years with a mentor, and taking all that inside information about those things and using that as a lens from which we look through at a person, individual, how they move, how they stand, and what do they actually need in regards to a strength and conditioning program. It tells us quite a bit when you see somebody's structure, which muscles are too short, which ones are getting lengthened, what needs to occur to create better balance, better alignment, so that the body is in a place where optimal performance can be hopefully achieved. And so that's been the journey of writing books. And of course, Joe, you know, like you start a podcast and now you're an instant expert authority overnight, right? And you write a book on surfing, and it fortunately it was the first of its kind. So, you know, I'm looked at as the expert when it comes to surf fitness. And there's been a lot of people out there since then that are doing a great job helping keep the surf population afloat, so to speak. But every now and then somebody will reach out and say, "Oh, I need to talk to you," and so on. So it's been a fun project, a fun journey, and I probably could have taken it further than I did, but I took it wherever it went to be. And I guess that's it for writing. I do now, what I do is I do online education in the forums. Instead of books, it's more interactive workshops, online courses, and of course going and presenting at conferences.
Absolutely. I always like to ask, you know, because I think it's fascinating, and eventually I probably get into writing the books at some point and sharing story, my story. But what, when you first started, right, was it something where you just wrote? Was it something that took a long time to put together? You know, how did you go about it? Because I know that, you know, I have certain people that took a long time, right, and kind of not dragged their feet, but needed more experience to do it. Or, you know, and then I have others where they wrote the book real fast, and then, you know, they got everything in there, and then it was out there. What was kind of your process? Was it, I want to write a book, and then it took a little while? Or, you know, you were kind of dead set and you had all the information, and then as you went through, you did more research. What was kind of your process in putting, you know, pen to paper, and then eventually from start to finish, getting it out there and getting it published?
Yeah, from start to finish, each book on average took about a year and a half, which I don't know if that's a long time or a short time. It's just what it took. And for me, I don't know if I would be considered ADD or ADHD. All I know is that I have a varying level of attention. And so I can be hyper-focused,
so yep.
Right?
Mm-hmm.
So you can let something go and have no attention on it. And then you pick it up and you're in it, and you don't want anything to distract you because you are just on this task. And that's kind of how it is for me. So there would be times where it would just hit me and I would be super focused on this. And every moment I could, in between appointments, I'd be on my laptop typing away. And then somebody would come in, I'd give them a program or do their training. And then I'd go right back to it. And it was almost like the trainings were kind of a distraction away from what I was really trying to get into. And then it would fizzle, and it would kind of settle down. And I wouldn't touch it. It would be on my laptop. It would be staring at me on my desktop every morning and every day until eventually a few weeks or a month or maybe even another a month and a half goes by. And then I click and open it up and I go at it again. So it was these cyclical bursts of creation. And how it really began was with a simple outline. I just outlined the types of information I wanted to get, which created the chapters. And then I created information underneath each chapter in the form of outlines. And then I expanded upon each one more and more. And before you knew it, that outline actually turned into the book itself. I would fill in gaps in the introduction. I would fill in gaps in the strength chapter or the flexibility chapter or whatever the case may be, and just expand. And then so one page outline turned into 150 pages or whatever of a book. But that was the process. And then came selecting the movements, creating the photographs. At that time, it was just pictures and placing them into the Word documents. The first book I self-published, and that was a fun adventure that I highly recommend to anybody, just because you get to see the entire process from soup to nuts. And then somewhere along the way with the second book, I thought, well, maybe the bigger publishing companies would have a greater reach and they would be able to help market, which was a very cruel lesson that I found that, no, you still promote your books. They really have very little to do with it. And you only get 10 cents of the dollar to every book sold, basically. So it was a hard lesson to learn, so that by the end, my last book, I did something in between. And there's hybrid publishing where they will help you bring it to fruition, but they only take a certain amount off the top. So I've done kind of the whole spectrum of self-publishing, hybrid, and big publishers to know where things went. But yeah, it was an interesting journey. The last book, The Return to Center, now with technology, I was able to embed QR codes next to every photograph or movement, which when you take your phone and you put the camera up to the QR code, a video from a YouTube video will pop up that I created. So everything is kind of interactive. Not only do you get the information on the pages, but you can get a video explaining deeper the strategy or the concept or whatever. So it becomes a bit more interactive. And one of the nice little caveats of having technology catch up with the publishing industry.
Yeah, wow, that's incredible. I didn't know you could put QR codes, but that's a great idea, like I said. And I also like about the, you know, writing a book with the ADHD where you were able to break it down, because that's always been one of my, you sit down and write, and I can't, there's no way I could sit down. I can't write a whole book in one sitting, but I also, it has to be categorized because I have to be able to go away for a month and then one day, oh, movement, squat patterns, and then we can just solely focus on that instead of looking at it as an entire book, right? Breaking everything down by chapter or whatever, so that you can take a month off and come back. And on the days it hits you, you can just write about a certain part as opposed to sit down and kind of write out the entire thing. I know people that do that. I actually a little jealous. I mean, but I wouldn't be a coach or the coach or the trainer I am without the ADHD, but certain times I'm like, man, I wish I could just sit down and write a book for 15 hours and no distractions and be nice and calm. But again, it's a give and a take.
Yeah, I think it helped to take some time off in between writing cycles, just because thoughts percolate to the surface. And what you had written down before, you're like, no, I'm going to change that up. Or, oh, I need to add this. Or to sit on a project and just let it just sit there. There's something to be said for that. And yeah, it would be nice just to get myself in a log cabin in the woods for a week and just type away. But I know that as soon as I'm done, I'm going to want to change it. So and being okay with that also, that was a hard lesson to learn. It's like, okay, it's going to the printer. This is the final draft, final copy. Are you okay with it? Yes, I guess I am. I'm okay with it. And I realized that I'm creating something that has imperfections that just allows more opportunity later, you know, allowing that. It's not the great American novel by any stretch. So yeah, being okay with letting things go. That's a good lesson, a good practice.
That's the next
letting
book.
Go.
That's the next book title.
There you go.
But no, I think it's great. I mean, I have to do it with programs. I have to hit save and be done, or else I'll sit there and stare at it and you know it will continuously going. And I want to talk to, because we did touch on this about somebody else I spoke to, had him on two or three episodes ago, but he also wrote a book and we talked about it. And like you said, having projects linger, right? And what we kind of label as is positive procrastination, right? And we talked about how procrastination is always looked as lazy, right? Oh, you procrastinate, you're lazy, you're, you know, whatever, you know, you shouldn't do that. Procrastination is bad, right? As opposed to looking at it as positive procrastination. Like you said, right? If we start writing a book and we're on chapter four, and then we get to a part where we don't know yet, right? And letting it kind of linger and like you said, stare back at you on the laptop and there's nothing there yet, right? But then maybe 6 weeks or 8 weeks down the road, boom, it hits you. And then we get back on that, right? Or if you're writing a memoir, right? And it takes you 10 years, maybe you weren't ready to write the full memoir when you first began, but then you got new experiences and new things that you learned after the 10 years. And without that 10 years of what's labeled as procrastination, your book or movie wouldn't be the same thing, right? And we kind of really dove into that. So I just want to get your opinion. We were talking about the brain and how we react about how, you know, what do you think about the label or the negative connotation, I think, of procrastination, where people look at that always as bad, right? Always as, you know, if we procrastinate, it's terrible. Whereas if you looked at it from that standpoint, no, sometimes you just need some more time to let the ideas filter or maybe, you know, get to an aha moment somewhere with a life experience.
That's good. I'm glad you bring that up because for a long time, I looked at procrastination as a negative aspect of my persona because it's something that I find myself doing, you know, those little things around the house that need repair that only take probably 5 minutes mm-hmm. of work, but it takes 6 months to get to it. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I would beat myself up over that. But then I realized, no, this is just the way that I achieve my goals. It may take a little time, but it's not like I am avoiding. It's just, no, it's that there's going to come a time where I'm going to be, okay, it's time to get those done. Yesterday is a great example. There was a screen door that needed to be adjusted. There were two broken pairs of sunglasses that my wife needed to be repaired. There was a couple of things in the garage that needed attention. And these things had been that way for probably a couple months. And it just so happened that I got in that mode. And I was in like, well, whether it's the creative or the repair mode or whatever it was, it hit and I got a whole bunch of things done. Now, interestingly enough, my wife is much more linear and she just takes things as they go and repairs or deals with them in a regular amount of time. And for me, it's more like a rabbit hopping from one location to another. But we've come to understand that that's how we live. And we begin to accept that that's neither a strength nor a weakness. It just is. And we can appreciate that and have a laugh out of it. And then realize, okay, this is his hyper or almost manic time of creation. And he's going to be gone to the studio doing a whole bunch of filming all day long. And it's going to go that way for about a week. And then he's going to stop. And there's going to be a month where he's going to just be going from one thing to another at a casual pace. And then, oh, here he goes again. And it's just, it's interesting. Procrastination, it's just a part of me. And it's neither negative nor positive. It's just how I get things done.
No, absolutely. I mean, same way. You know, I was all of high school and probably all of college. I'll admit it. I was the one that did the assignments at 12 o'clock at night when the assignment was due at 6:30 in the morning. But I wrote 8-page papers in 10 hours. I mean, it's just that's how it is. And I think that, but I think it's this, you know, again, we come up with the labels just like the corrective exercise where it's procrastination's bad or you need to be on all the time with your business or you need to pick a thing and that's all you think about night and day. And you need to sleep on your couch in an office for 25 hours. And I think that, you know, again, we talked about it, identifying the why, right? Why are you doing this? Or I think deeper, what's your why in terms of how are you comfortable with things or how do you get things done, right? You and I, very similar. I'm a procrastinator. So I know that if I want to write programs, let's say with golf performance, and I get that little, you know, that little buzzer goes off, we're going to have to, I keep pads all over the house and everywhere because now when it hits, there's no going back and we jot everything down. I'm not the type of person, I can't get up and say tomorrow at 2:30, I'm going to work on X, Y, and Z for 4.5 hours. It just doesn't work that way. And I think, and I want to know too, if you get this, I can always do physical things over sitting around and doing busy work all the time, right? It doesn't matter how I feel, if I'm tired or whatever, you know, but if it's like, oh, it's nice out, let's go for a run, or let's go to the gym, right? I can always push myself, play golf or do a sport. That's not a problem. It's always the book things, the writing the blogs or doing the descriptions for the podcast. That's always my biggest thing. What do you like about the podcast? I said, well, I love talking to people, but the hardest thing for me is writing three sentences about what we just talked about and then hitting that post to, you know, post to platform button at the end.
Yeah, I think we're in the same category when it comes to physical movements. I think I mentioned earlier in our conversation that working out was a great form of procrastination. Instead of studying for exams, I'd hit the weight room. And it's the same thing, whether it's surfing or working out. If there's something I need to do, it's so much easier to just go move my body, and which is a blessing, right? It's not like I'm procrastinating by sitting and watching reruns of The Cosby Show or whatever you want to say, right? It's that I'm actually getting some physical movement and doing something with my body. So it's not all that bad, but it's definitely part of me. And I have taken a tremendous amount of time and energy in the past to try and change that. But I don't know if it's something that truly can be changed. I can bring awareness to it. And if that is all I can do is just be aware that, okay, I am preferring to do this, that means that I'm aware that I need to get some other stuff done. So I think really, yeah, procrastination is just part of me, but I do have the gift of awareness. And as long as I can maintain that, through all aspects of life for that matter, but awareness of not only my physical frame, awareness of my tasks or my roles in my day-to-day, awareness of my relationships with others, aware of the relationship with myself. I mean, it really boils down to that. So yeah, I don't know. We've gotten away from the strength coach experience in a way and gotten into the ethereal plane, but I don't mind. I hope you don't.
Oh, absolutely not. It's an experience, right? It's your experience. And then it's kind of delving. And I always like to talk about these things because I think they're things that everybody goes through, right? Because especially in an age of a book, right? Here's exactly how you're supposed to do everything, right? Or you should be doing X, Y, and Z. And for me, the same thing, it's an awareness where there was a time where I felt guilty. Oh my God, I'm procrastinating, right? I said I was going to do X, Y, and Z, and then I didn't. And, or all these other things come up where in terms similar to you, it's like, oh, but what have I done in between, right? If I go out for a 20-minute run instead of, you know, writing a program, that's not terrible, right? It's not, again, it's not like you're watching Netflix. I think it's being aware of in just that scenario is, what are you doing instead, right? If you're doing a podcast instead of, you know, I don't know, paying credit card bills, not that, you know, you should let credit card bills go over, but that's just an example. But if you're doing things that are positive and they're helping you, I think that's okay too, right? And I think it's important to just bring understanding to that because there are so many books now of how I do this, or you go on Instagram and you see the billionaires who are insane and all they do is work, and there's no, you know, downtime, or at least they don't show you any of their downtime on Instagram. And I think what it does is it makes people start to feel guilty of who they are and how they are, instead of, I think, great, you know, self-awareness and being aware of, okay, I'm not going to be able to sit down for 8 hours and write ideas, but maybe I'll get 1 or 2 hours, you know, today, or maybe say, okay, this week I'm going to get 3 hours of hard work done all together for my business or this new thing I want to do. But I just think it's important just to bring the awareness, because with the social media that we talked about, there's just so much pressure to identify a goal and then drive a Bugatti in a week. And I think that just puts so much pressure on people, instead of saying, okay, what do I need to do? Well, if I'm going to edit my podcast today, I need to go on a run for 20 minutes first and then come back in and eat. And then I can edit my podcast, right? Or things of that sort, right? Identifying what is working for you and how can I do that, instead of comparing yourself again to the work ethic or the work preferences of other people. I think that's kind of a slippery slope that happens, especially too with working out too, right? Oh, I need to work out 6 days a week because XYZ does it. Whereas maybe you get three in or two or whatever.
No, I agree. I mean, especially where I'm located, right on the other side of the mountains from Silicon Valley. We have .com executives that come into our studio whether it be Apple, Google, Facebook, eBay, we've had them all. And since the mid 90s, when things really started erupting, and the work culture, fortunately, has changed with those individuals that have come in here. And I think COVID, of course, helped with that, where they're all remotely working from home. But prior to that just like you were mentioning, the billionaires that are just nonstop, they don't have anything outside of that. I mean, people were squeaking in 1 hour in two times a week. And then they were over on their campus working, 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 sleeping on the couch, and so on. We don't have as many like that, but it still exists, and it permeates our culture here on the Central Coast. So it's something that is present. It's obviously quite evident, and it's something that is really it's a challenge not to fall into that minute by minute, I've got to be doing something. It's again the importance of being bored. There's a good title for a book right there. The importance of being bored, to just be okay with sitting and doing nothing. There's something to be said about that. To just keep up revving your engine at the red line, whether it's with a high intensity interval training that has become present in our world, in our industry, or just in the corporate world of go, go, go. We need downtime. I would love to take the European work model and take 4 to 6 weeks a year off of work and see how productive we could be.
Absolutely. And then they have the gap year as well after college. You know, you go out and you just travel, right? And just to bring it back around, but we talked about the brain and the neuroplasty and stuff. And there's great studies about when you move to other places or when you go to places that you've never been before, your brain identifies that and says, okay, we need to make new patterns, right? Much probably what happened with you when you moved from the East Coast to now over here, your brain naturally has to figure new things out, and it kind of expands based on what we're doing, right? And where you are with your life. So I think that ability to travel or just as much as you can, you know, getting away is important because, you know, but it's not related to that, right? It's, oh, well, you just go on vacation and party. When in reality, if you looked at it as a from a neuroscience standpoint, it's actually you're giving your brain a break, and then you're going away, and then your brain is coming up with different pathways and getting stronger and kind of adapting to the new place and the new things that you're dealing with.
Well said. Well said. Exactly. Change is key. And now, just minor changes, little tweaks, or big changes, but we constantly have to encourage that, because otherwise, stagnancy just in the physical body, stagnancy creates inflammation of joints, right? We get arthritis, and but flowing and moving creates circulation, stimulation. So,
Yep,
agreed.
absolutely. And then what I want to go to just before, because I want to make sure we get into when you started your gym, right? Like going from moving out there and doing all those things, how was that process? And then until you to where you are now, you kind of go into that a little bit as well.
Well, anytime you start a business, anytime you have like major life changes or challenges, there are these two opposing emotions that take over. Fearful over joy, right? It's like when you get married or have children or even graduating from school and not knowing what's coming up in their future. There are these two polar opposite emotions that are constantly at wits with you. And so it was scary as heck. But exciting as all could be, right? Opening up your own studio in your mid to late 20s, this was something else. And of course, here we are, 26 years later, and the journey has been quite remarkable. A lot of learning lessons, a lot of growth, and a lot of shrinking, and a lot of growth, and a lot of shrinking. It's just almost like there's a heartbeat in the physical makeup of the studio itself, as well as the business cycle itself. There's this constant ebb and flow, and so that's been remarkable. And we first started doing whatever we could. We'll throw whatever on the wall and see whatever it sticks. We were doing outdoor rowing training out of the Santa Cruz Harbor with these catamaran-like row crafts. We were doing cooking classes in the studio. I had acupuncturists and chiropractors and massage therapists and Pilates and yoga instructors. I mean, we were expanding, and then that shrunk back down to just a one-man operation. And then I grew back up from there and got a whole bunch of independent contractors renting out space to the point where it was suffocating. There were so many. And then we had to expand. And then we got rid of independent contractors and started an employee model, and all this amazing journey that continues on. And now for me, we have the brick and mortar, and we've got a nice system in place that is almost self-managing and self-regulating. We've got a great staff, and which is hard to find, especially in these days. I think everyone has a hiring problem right now, or a hiring challenge, an opportunity that is not necessarily ideal. But now my path is more of an educator to therapists and trainers and coaches, and putting out more content and doing workshops. So that's a different current kind of career path within the business itself. So it's been remarkable, Joe. I enjoy the process. I never really tire of it. And the things that I tire of, I just start to focus in a different direction and allow others to take those areas over, and maybe visit them from time to time to just stimulate and remind, but mostly it allows me to go in different directions.
Yeah, absolutely. It's an amazing story. And I always enjoy the hearing about that model, because if I were ever to do that, that is the model that I would want. Is you build and you work, right? And then once you get the brick and mortar down, and then once you have, you know, people in there that you trust, and everything runs kind of the way you want from years of experience, it then allows you to go do other things and kind of expand in other directions, right? And you know, a lot of the places I've worked, I see it at the other way, right? You have people that they have a gym and they spend time in the gym and that's it. And they're in the gym and they're, you know, they do that for 40 years, and you kind of see them get kind of broken down, right? A little bit. Not that it's not good, but it's because they haven't mastered that brick and mortar part that you talked about. So I love hearing about that, because I've seen the burnout, and I always question to myself is, you know, when I was living in New York City, it's why don't you bring people in here to help you with X, Y, and Z so you can expand certain things, right? Instead of, but I also think that's an ego thing, right? You have to control everything. A lot of gym owners, unfortunately, have to control everything. And the last thing in the world they want is to kind of hand the keys over.
Well, and for me too, family comes into play. Like my wife and I, we built a family. We have a couple of kids. And so in the earlier years, for the last, say, 15 to now almost 20, that's the ages of my kids. Before that, the priority was to raise your family and to devote time and parenting and family. And that meant that there wasn't going to be a lot of traveling. There wasn't going to be a lot of presenting and educating. But now we're at a point in our family life where opportunity is now affording us to go and do that. So not that I didn't want to do it earlier, I did, but I saw that if I chose that, I saw what a lot of other presenters were going through that were on like the speaking circuit. And many of them were very good at the speaking, but their personal lives were actually disintegrating because of so much travel and so much demand. But I thought, you know, that's a good lesson for me to pay attention to. I think I'll wait until the kids are a little older. And that'll give me enough time to develop more insight and information that I can share with others. And so that's where I am right now.
Absolutely. I think the balance is the key, right? Making sure that everything is well balanced, right? And again, like just like you talked about with the programs, going in and examining and then kind of coming out and making sure, you know, looking at it from afar, you know, that 30,000 view, and then going in there and honing it in. I just want to go through too about when you started speaking, right? How did that kind of take place? Was that from the books in the gym, or was it something that you actively wanted to get involved in? How did that start? And then how did you kind of, what was your process as you did it to kind of get better at it, and you know, kind of the things you did to progress with that?
Oh, good question. No, I've always enjoyed public speaking. I've always enjoyed kind of being a teacher in a way, or instructor. It just seemed to be something that came natural. And it was kind of, I won't say a drug of choice, but it was just definitely stimulating for me. And so I think I did the typical public speaking pattern where you start locally. And so I would do something within my community and I would offer to speak at different organizations, whether it was a Lions Club or a Kiwanis or Rotarians or just anything like that, putting together little workshops and any kind of speaking opportunity that came my way, I'd put something together. And then also there was an opportunity to do a little bit of radio. And so I've been doing that for many, many years. And that was nice practice to sit in front of a mic and to speak maybe in front of an audience or not in front of an audience. And that was really quite fun. But then it developed into, okay, now I belong to the National Strength Conditioning Association. So they are looking for presenters for their state clinic in Northern California. And then there was also Southern California state clinics. And so I started presenting there. And that was probably about 15 years ago, maybe 10, yeah, 10 or 15. So I could do this every now and then, every few months, I might every once a year speak at this state clinic, but stay locally. So I wasn't kind of pulling away from the family. And eventually it turned into regional conferences. And then from regional, it became national. And from national, it became international. And that's kind of where it is now, is just speaking, well, virtually internationally, but soon with restrictions being lifted in other locations, then now starting to travel abroad and put on continuing education courses or workshops, and going to places like the Perform Better Summits. I really enjoy that. I think it's one of the best 3-day conferences you can have for rehab to conditioning. And if your listening audience is not familiar with Perform Better, I would highly recommend it. They've got Orlando, Providence, Rhode Island, Chicago, and typically Long Beach, California, which is one I would go to every year since, so I think 2005, 2006 was my first attendance, and it just blew me away. So many light bulb moments coming through with some amazing presenters, and you just listen, you pay attention, you keep on going back, and before you know it, you are one of the presenters. So, and that's just been a great kind of process. And so, if anybody's interested in becoming a public speaker, starting locally and advancing on to more geographically bigger and bigger locations, I think that's it. For me, it was a very successful way of going.
Absolutely. Yes. And it's a great piece of advice again for anybody that wants to do that, because I know that there is already the fear of public speaking, right? And then once you get through that part, then it's how do I build, right? How do I start to talk? Because it's hard to kind of there's not a lot of in between, right? You see the guys on the stage presenting and the YouTube stuff, but it's very hard to find the advice for in between, right? How do I start, right? Because nobody's going to call you at your house, maybe, but be like, oh, would you like to speak at, Dallas Cowboy Stadium in front of 100,000 people about your life, right? It starts out slower, and then we kind of grow there from that.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, just like any rock band, you start out in your garage and then before you know it, you're playing at the LA Coliseum, right? Yeah. It takes a while. Somebody said it takes 10 years to be an overnight success. So don't feel like you have to go right out the door and jam at the big venues. Just start with just having conversations with your clients and then put on little clinics or I've been doing meetup.com, where you got all these different groups of different interests, and I put on a monthly meetup conversation and do a little bit of it just helps with your public speaking skills, where you can do it either in person or online. So meetup.com was really a nice tool for me to use as well.
Absolutely. What is next for the future, right? For foreseeable future, some goals or some stuff you're doing?
Well, I have been under the tutelage, shall we say. I've been studying. I have a mentor, which I recommend to all trainers, all coaches, to have mentors in your life, leaders and guides. His name is Gary Ward, and he is over in London. He has a company called Anatomy in Motion, and they teach courses in person prior to COVID all around, from Australia to Ireland, England, Germany, and the US and Canada. And so, over the course of the last couple of years, he's taken some of his, I would say, put my ego aside, some of his top students in all regions of the world. And we have become educators for this company of Anatomy in Motion. And we teach closed chain biomechanics for the lower body, the upper body. We break down the gait cycle and look at what every joint does and so on. And there's a lot of coursework that we cover. And so in the future, coming up, probably starting at this fall and going into 2023, I'll be traveling and offering these 2 to 4 day workshops for therapists and coaches alike, and understanding really what the body does when the feet are on the ground compared to what the anatomy books tell us when the body's on a table. So we kind of look at that. And then I've got my own courses and workshops that I'm developing and taking some of that information and filtering it into a strength and conditioning venue. And then, like I mentioned, Perform Better. I've got some speaking gigs coming up with them in Orlando, Florida at the beginning of June. And hopefully just continuing on that kind of path, we'll put together some eBooks, just little booklets, different facets of conditioning or different career positions, different sports and what we might want to do to help train those individuals. So as you can tell, I've got a really boring life and I've got nothing going on.
Yeah, it looks terrible. And you could surf at any point if you want. Yeah, it's just.
That's true. That's as soon as we hang up, I think that's the nice thing. I've got a wetsuit hanging in my office and the
procrastination.
Board is not far
there
away.
It is. See,
I got to go procrastinate. I really do. It helps with the creative juices.
Exactly. And then if anybody wants to, get a hold of you, with the website and things, just tell everybody, all the listeners, what those things are. Just if anybody, wants to ask questions or get to know you a little bit more, get some more information, especially I know on the website, you have that list of those upcoming speaking engagements as well.
Yeah, you can. I mean, just my name, Rocky Snyder, Snyder. That's kind of what I use for all social media. Whether you look for me on Facebook or Instagram, it's Rocky_Snyder. I have a YouTube channel by that name, and my website is rockysnyder.com. So you can check out all that. I'd love for you to follow me on Instagram. I try and post something on a regular basis and announce the other podcasts. And you'll find Joe's was a guest on one of the podcasts, so you'll check him out as well. And yeah, that sums it up. I love talking shop to anybody. So if there's any aspiring trainers out there, just give me a message through Instagram or Facebook or whatever, or email me through the website. Happy to chat with you. And just like chatting with you, Joe, I really enjoyed this.
Oh, absolutely. I do enjoy it too. And in the future, I think we'll do a few more. Also, just so everybody on the Strength Coach Experience Instagram, for everybody that follows, right, when I put the post out for this podcast, I will also include Rocky's Instagram, right? And then I believe there's a link right to your website in your bio on the Instagram as well. So you'll have that information too, and you'll be able to reach him.
Excellent.
Well, Rocky, thank you so much. I appreciate it. And it's always a pleasure talking to you. Always a lot of fun. I think we could have gone for another 3-4 hours.
I wouldn't have a problem with that, Joe. You're really great to have a conversation with. I appreciate your time.
Thank you. I do. You too.